Today, all about housing bubbles. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics, Washington Analytics Post, covering finance and problem news with a distinctively Australian flavour. And I have a very special guest with me today. You may recognise him, you may not. Joe, hello.
Hello, Martin. Great to be with you.
Thank you very much for spending some time with me in the studio. We were out at Wollongong this morning. Mm-hmm. Let's just do the introductions. So you, of course, are infamous or famous for a certain podcast.
Yes, the Jolly Swagman podcast, which I started with my uni mate Angus in 2017. I do the podcast myself now. Gus moved to New York. And a lot of the coverage has been on the Australian housing market, which is a pet interest of mine.
Right. Well, as you know, it's a pet interest of mine too, and so we have a lot in common. Yeah. And I know that you've been thinking hard about property bubbles, right? And I think it's a really good time to have a conversation around what is a bubble, right? Do we know when we're in one? And what are the consequences of bubbles if they exist? Mm. So maybe a historical perspective would be a good place to start, though.
Yeah. So the world's first bubble, or so we're told, was the Dutch tulip bubble, which famously crashed in February 1637. There may have been real estate bubbles before that. In the writings of Livy, you find murmurings of a real estate bubble on the Palatine Hill in Rome. Even before that, there was allegedly a Roman real estate bubble which burst when Caesar crossed the Rubicon. Before there were housing bubbles, there were land bubbles. America and Australia, our histories are bound up in real estate speculation. The Virginia companies of Plymouth and London, which set sail to colonize America from England, were real estate companies. And many of the founding fathers of America were essentially real estate speculators moonlighting as constitutional drafters. Australia too, as early as I think it was 1812 or 1814, Governor Macquarie set a ban on land speculation. You needed to hold the land for a minimum of 5 years. So it was very much a feature of these frontier colonies.
Right. So just let me ask, when you say a bubble, right, a common characteristic is speculation. A common characteristic is a very significant inflation in value.
Yeah.
Does it always have to have a crash?
Okay, yeah. So let's talk about, because this is an often used but very poorly understood term. Yeah. And I think the financial media has a lot of blame to accept here, because bubble makes a great headline and it gets the clicks, but people are incredibly confused about what it really is. So let's clarify that. So let me start this way. Matt Barry and Craig Tyndale, two mates of mine, wrote a famous viral blog post in 2017 called Australia's Economy is a House of Cards. Mm. And in the article, they say Australia's housing bubble is the longest running housing bubble in the world. And they cite a study the Bank of International Settlements did in 2017, where they said that Australian house prices have increased 6,556% since 1961. But is that really a bubble? Does that mean that a bubble has existed in Australia since the early 1960s? I think it's a strange way to define a bubble to just point to a large price run-up. Mm. For example, I can tell you that between 2003 and 2013, real home prices, so adjusted for inflation, increased 13.1% per annum in China's tier one cities, so China's most economically successful cities. Mm. Is that evidence of a rollicking Sino real estate bubble, or is it just an appropriate reflection of GDP and income growth in China? So that really gets us to the first part of the definition of what is a bubble. You always need some sort of ratio or comparison of prices, the market prices that we observe, to fundamental or intrinsic value. The next question is, what constitutes intrinsic value in the property market? And in the academic literature, there are three sort of broad approaches to measuring intrinsic value. I'll step quickly through each of them. So the first says that, and this goes back to Alfred Marshall in 1890, when he said that, you know, the value of a thing in the long term should correspond to the cost of production. So the first view is that the fundamental value of real estate should be pinned to construction costs. Mm. And this view says that land is of sort of limited value because it, you know, it has agricultural use, but there's a lot of supply. And therefore the key variable is how much it costs to whack up the building on top of the land. I don't think this is necessarily the best measure for fundamental value insofar as the Sydney and Melbourne housing markets are concerned, where supply is relatively inelastic. But in the long run, it's certainly a very powerful way of thinking about housing and what housing's fundamental value should be. The second broad way of thinking about intrinsic value is getting a collection of local economic variables and putting them into some sort of model. So thinking about things like income, interest rates, demographics, and how they interact with supply. And I think this is a very fraught approach. It's open to data mining, omitting important variables, and has a bad track record in housing bubbles in the past. The third approach and final approach is a finance-oriented approach, which is to think, what is the present discounted value of the cash flow generated by the asset? So, you know, in stocks, it'd be the present discounted value of the dividend stream. In property, it's the rents. And I think as a, you know, street smart, quick and dirty, back of the coaster heuristic to test the existence of a housing bubble, the price to rent ratio is really important. Because here we're building in both those components. The price goes to the market price, obviously, and the rents go to the fundamental value. So there's a chart which we'll put up, which I want to show you. This chart's from John Cochrane. And this is the best one chart portrait, a single image or cartoon depicting a housing bubble that I've ever come across. So what you'll see in the chart is a dotted line. This is for the United States, a dotted line beginning in the 1960s, which tracks where US house prices would be if they followed a roughly 20x price to rent ratio. Above that, we have the Case-Shiller index, and then in the middle is the government index, slightly different to the Case-Shiller index. And what you see beginning around 1997, 1998 is these two real house price indexes kind of bounce up off the long run equilibrium and crash back down in what we now refer to as the subprime mortgage crisis. Mm. So that, I think, is a fantastic illustration of a housing bubble. Now, using Nigel Stapledon's data, Nigel Stapledon at UNSW and Westpac, who produced Australia's long-run house price index back to 1890, I produced an Australian version of this chart, which essentially shows the same thing. Beginning in the late 90s, our house prices come way up above rents. To come back to your original question, Martin, that's the first component. We need some sort of divergence between market price and intrinsic value, mm-hmm. defining intrinsic value in relation to rents. The second thing is, and this understanding is inspired by Bob Schiller, who came on my podcast. We had a 2-hour conversation and we discussed Australia's real estate bacchanalia. And Bob defines a bubble as a broad psychosocial phenomenon of a feedback loop mediated by prices. So people are, you know, bubbles usually begin for good reason. There's some kind of improvement in fundamentals. Minsky and Kindleberger refer to this as a displacement or some fantastic new technology, something that's grounded in sensible analysis. And then it's over extrapolated and people begin to react to the prices themselves. So that is fundamentally a question of anthropology, sociology, psychology. And you want to see whether that speculation is driving the divergence between market price and intrinsic value. Mm. And the reason that's an important part of the definition is it increases the probability of a crash insofar as a bubble entails a crash, which I think is how most people would understand a bubble. The reason it entails a crash is if people are only invested for the capital appreciation, they're not invested for the intrinsic value, they're just looking to sell the price, sell the asset onto a greater fool. Mm. Then once prices peak, the cycle reinforces on the downside, and people try to escape and, you know, sell as quickly as possible, which is something that exacerbates the crash.
Right.
So two parts: the divergence between market price and fundamentals, and speculation. And we can talk about evidence of speculation in the Australian housing market. But I think the question of whether Australia has a housing bubble is the easy question. Like, I mean, obviously, this is a housing bubble. It's historically unique in that we've kept it on life support for two decades now, which, to my knowledge, has never happened in history. But it is clearly a housing bubble. The more difficult question is when and whether and how it will end.
Okay, well, we'll touch on that in a second. Yeah. Let me just pick up 2 points.
Because
I think that there's a really important observation that you've made there about the psychological feedback loop. In other words, the run of the crowd, right? More people want to get in, therefore it drives prices higher that more people want to get in, right?
Yeah.
I think some economists have underestimated that force in terms of actually trying to understand what's going on. The other thing, though, of course, is that the bubble to an extent is supported by government policy and what politicians do. And I think that's something else that people need to be thinking about when they actually try and spot a bubble, because often the reason that things go the way they go is not necessarily to do with intrinsic value, but it's the political intervention, meddling, whatever you want to say, right?
Yeah.
And I'd suggest to you, in Australia, we've got issues with intrinsic value, but we've got issues with the psychology, and we've got issues with government intervention as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So let me echo both of those sentiments. I agree that speculation and studying the psychology is very important. I think it is as important as it is difficult to quantify, and it's very difficult to find macro tests for animal spirits, to use Keynes's term, but it doesn't mean it's not there, and it shouldn't be considered. And yes, I think predicting Australia's housing cycles is now as much a matter of political economy as it is of economics and finance. And our cycles have been so interesting in that they are volatile, and invariably the key turning points are driven by regulators or the central bank. Why I think that's additionally interesting is it creates a narrative that the cycle, you know, this is being managed, this is healthy, everything's under control, this is all deliberate. And it's almost like we've been putting our foot on the gas, taking it off, on the brake a little bit, on the gas, toggling back and forth for the last 2 decades. Mm. We've never actually tested the ceiling of the housing bubble, maybe mercifully, but in the way, for example, they did in the United States, where things got so egregious at the end there. Like last night, I caught up for beers with Michael Hare, who's a complexity researcher at UCID. We catch up every month or two, and he has a paper, it hasn't been published yet, but the housing market in the US literally cracks at the top. This is about a year before prices start declining. The second derivative goes from increasing, so the price index goes from accelerating to decelerating. To his knowledge, no other housing bubble in history has done that. And they just got so extreme at the, you know, they do everything bigger in America, including their housing bubbles. You know, like in 2005, more than 20% of loan originations were subprime. They were pouring credit into poor neighborhoods like they were trying to make foie gras. And it got so extreme that it broke at the top in a way that forced a narrative revision. We haven't had that moment yet. Now, that opens another question about narratives, which I think is something really interesting to talk about, something I've been thinking a lot about since the conversation with Bob Shiller. So if we go back to that chart of mine, which compares Australia's, you know, long run 20x price to rent ratio with real prices, you can think about multiple equilibria. So maybe the bottom line where prices would be if they were 20x annual rental yield, we could call that the fundamental equilibrium. The top line, actual prices we observe in the market, we could think of that as the bubble equilibrium. And that is being kept afloat by narratives about the market. And lurking beneath it is maybe what's the equilibrium that's closer to fundamental value. Now, narratives are unavoidable, inescapable, essential, necessary in financial markets because the future is inherently uncertain, number one. And number two, houses are long-lived, durable assets. This is not like a market for consumer perishables where you buy and consume immediately. Those markets are remarkably efficient, according to Vernon Smith, the Nobel laureate who recently appeared on my podcast. Markets for long-lived durables are very inefficient because they last for so long, therefore they can be retraded. So people buy and hold for the resale value. And as soon as that happens in an uncertain world, you introduce or narratives about the future become very, very important. Now, whenever I caught up with some finance guys last week and started going on my narrative spiel, and I lost at least one of them immediately. And the problem is, whenever you talk about narratives, to some people you sound very wise, to other people you sound very flaky. And the flaky people have a point because it is very hard to quantify these things and actually connect them to prices. But let me give you an example of what I regard to be a clear narrative in the Australian housing market. And I think Bob Shiller agrees with this as well. So in the last phase of the housing bubble, so I said there are two phases so far to Australia's housing bubble. The first phase from 98 to 2007, I call the Howard phase, thanks to the capital gains tax discount. And the second phase from 2012 to 2017, roughly, I call the Stevens phase after Glenn Stevens. So in the Stevens phase, we're talking about 2012 to 2017, the Reserve Bank and the Treasury, Australia's two key economic institutions, agreed that the impact of foreign buyers on house prices was very limited. There's a RBA paper from 2014 and a Treasury paper from 2016 which run the analysis. And this was contrary to my experience. You know, I started paying attention to the Australian housing market in 2017. And everyone was talking about the Chinese buyers. Even, you know, very, very smart friends, even people who work in finance, whose opinions I respected, were telling me about the Chinese buyers pushing up prices. I would attend auctions just because I like to kind of see what happens on the ground as well. And when I'm at auctions, I always strike up a conversation with the people around me just to hear how people are justifying and rationalizing the market. And again, people would tell me it's the Chinese buyers. And then I heard the same narratives in the downturn from mid-2017 to mid-2019. It's because of the capital controls and the foreign buyers leaving. So I was thinking this is, you know, where Australia is leveraged to the foreign buyers. But as I said, it turns out that's not true. I mean, they are there, but only in a very limited way. Now, compare that empirical truth to a survey done by Dallas Rogers, an academic at the University of Sydney in 2016, where he surveys 900-odd residents of Greater Sydney and asks them a number of questions. And one of the most interesting questions is, what do you think is influencing house prices? Pick up to three factors, and there's a list of factors. The number one factor people picked, so 64.4% of respondents picked this factor, which was about twice as much as the next largest factor, was foreign investors buying houses in the Sydney market. Mm. He then asked them, do you agree with this statement? You know, strongly disagree, neutral, agree, strongly agree. And the statement was foreign investors have no or a very small impact on house price rises in Sydney. And 77.9% of people strongly disagreed or disagreed with that statement. In other words, gave the wrong answer. So that to me is an example of a narrative. Mm-hmm. And it probably taps into a deeper undercurrent of, so, you know, narratives are persuasive in the context of pre-existing narratives. It probably links into what I call the liberty of distance narrative, as opposed to, you know, Jeffrey Blaney's tyranny of distance. But this idea that Australia is a safe, stable, isolated democracy with great beaches. A lot of Chinese and Hong Kong buyers genuinely believe that about Australia, and they're probably right. But we think, we know that they believe that. And so that's what's important. And it maybe even taps into even longer running narratives that are more xenophobic about, you know, Chinese people coming to Australia. So the theories about foreign buyers are a narrative which helps justify and rationalize elevated prices. So that's a very persuasive, I think it's fascinating, an example of a narrative in the Australian housing market. And there are many other narratives we can talk about.
So let me ask then, what's the difference between that and propaganda?
So as I would understand propaganda, propaganda is devised, produced, and emitted by a central authority like a government. And I don't think this narrative is centralized in any way. I think it's a narrative that emerges
bubbles up from the bottom, out of the ether.
Out of the proverbial barbecue conversations.
Okay, right. And that's interesting because my surveys echo what you just said, which is that a lot of people, 2 or 3 years ago in particular, were saying, oh, it's foreign buyers, right?
Yeah.
The truth is, it's probably more to do with debt availability.
Yeah.
Which was actually, when I do my modelling on home prices and what's driven that, I think that debt is the real question here, right?
Yeah.
People were able to borrow more, that lifted prices, that got people more excited, they were able to borrow more, the banks were able to lend more, and so you had that virtuous circle and the prices went up, right? Now, if that's true, then there's an interesting question that follows from it, which at what point is there so much debt that you can't go on making more debt, right? And I'm interested in those sort of break points. Right.
Yeah.
At which point, you know, does the narrative break down, or does the ability to be able to continue the journey fall away? Right. Simply because it's no longer feasible to be able to drive it the same way.
Yeah.
I'm interested in those disconnection points because I think we're seeing some of those currently.
Yeah. So I don't have a strong opinion on whether we're at that breaking point. Like the United States, that housing bubble, as I said, that was a clear breaking point.
Yep.
That was a housing bubble pushed to the extreme.
Yep.
Like one of the big puzzles out of that bubble, and you, this is interesting because you struggle to reconcile it with a rational agent's view of the world, is what happened to Las Vegas and Phoenix. I remember driving into Las Vegas from San Francisco in 2016 with a mate in a hire car. I was traveling around the United States, and it's just desert for miles, 360 degrees around the city. So Las Vegas is a supply elastic city. So the supply is virtually unlimited, and so too Phoenix, but to a slightly lesser extent. In 2003, the bubble in America started on the West Coast, Seattle, LA, moved to the East Coast, and then started inland as well. So there was kind of a spatial dimension to it. And when it came inland, so Vegas and Phoenix were late to the party, but they made up for it. Prices in Vegas in 2003, real house prices, rose 10%. 2004, they rose 49% in 1 year. In Phoenix, 10% in 2004, 43% in 2005. Like, that is just extreme. And when that happens, you can do some mathematical calculations around what's the capacity of people to carry debt. You're coming up against the ceiling of the bubble. But for Australia, I feel like it's more difficult because we've been just edging this thing for so long. Now, you do raise an interesting question, though, about how do housing bubbles end?
Mm.
So if we agree that Australia is clearly nursing a big old housing bubble at the moment, then when and how is it going to end? It's very difficult to answer in the abstract how do housing bubbles end. But usually it's in one of two ways. One, there's some kind of credit supply shock, which means that banks can't lend as much, which, as you know, necessarily decreases house prices, and then price belief feedback starts, and then that forces the narrative to change, like what happened in America. And you get to a point where faith in the market is just shattered. So go to Japan, you know, a decade into their lost decade, or maybe it's lost two decades now, and you can get fantastic yields in Tokyo. You ask people why they're not investing, and it's because house prices always go down. So eventually the narratives will change after a credit supply shock, but it begins with a credit supply shock. The other way is just the narratives change on their own, and that's sufficient to bring the bubble equilibrium back down. And an example of a bubble that ends that way might be the Los Angeles and Boston housing bubble of the late 1980s. So there were some regional bubbles in America and indeed around the world in the 1980s. And Bob Shiller, for example, thinks that there wasn't a lot that fundamentally changed until the recession of the early 90s, but there were things like the Gulf War, which created a lot of economic uncertainty, and so people started to sour on the housing market. Just to go back to the credit supply shock one, I can tell you exactly when the Spanish housing bubble ended, the Spanish housing bubble of the 2000s. So the Spanish housing bubble of the 2000s ended on the 9th of August, 2007. And what happened on the 9th of August, 2007 was BNP Paribas announced that it was freezing three of its funds because of the securitization market and subprime loans souring in America. And that dried up liquidity to the Spanish banks. The average loan, mortgage loan size dropped from there, and the rest is history. I'll put up a chart by a Spanish economist, Sergi Basco, which shows that. So you can almost pinpoint the moment the Spanish housing bubble broke. So the question is, you know, is Australia going to have a similar credit supply shock? For a while there, I thought, you know, the Royal Commission had done it, but I underestimated APRA. I took APRA at its word when it said it wasn't going to remove the minimum serviceability buffer.
Yep.
In hindsight, that was a mistake, because if you thought the RBA was also going to cut rates, which I did, that would have been ineffectual without APRA removing the minimum serviceability buffer. So that was kind of mutually contradictory. In hindsight, it doesn't look to me like that. That's the credit supply shock it was anymore. It's just very hard to predict because there's ironclad consensus around the housing bubble on the part of Australia's regulators and governments in a way that is just baffles me. So then, okay, if we can't really say what the credit supply shock will be, maybe we can look at the narratives. But as soon as you do that, you're talking about a complex system with nonlinear dynamics, and that is inherently difficult to predict. Yeah. So you're sort of left in a position where I think Paul Samuelson, the Nobel Prize winning economist, had it exactly right when he wrote in 1957 that I've long been struck by the fact, and puzzled by it too, that in all of economic theory, we have absolutely no way of saying how long a bubble will last. To say that prices will eventually fall represents a safe but empty prediction. But whether they will be overvalued by 10% or to the tune of hundreds of percent, we simply do not know. So I think that's essentially the conundrum we're stuck with. We have a housing bubble, but it would be intellectually dishonest for me to say that I can say when it's going to end.
I think that's right. And that's one of the reasons, by the way, why I run different scenarios, right?
Yes.
Because I don't believe it's possible to make a watertight prediction as to what's going to happen, right?
Yeah.
What you can say is there are a bunch of different potential scenarios that may play out. And in this situation, this might happen, that might happen.
Mm.
But that's as far as you can go. Partly because it's a very complex system with lots of interrelationships. Partly because you can't underestimate the political interventions and political meddling that will go on, because the housing sector is such a critical component of the total Australian economy. And frankly, there are banks are completely wired into it. Our broader economy is wired into it. Think about things like stamp duty and those sorts of things.
Yeah.
And the other factor is that there are lots of externalities. I mean, if you think of the GFC, that was created because of issues in Europe, but ultimately it flew into a liquidity problem, which hit us down here as well.
Yeah.
So we've always got that international perspective too. And so you're trying to predict international situations, you're trying to predict political manifestations of policy, and you know, you're trying to predict a whole bunch of other things too. So I don't think it's feasible to say watertight, it's going to be the year after next.
Yeah, yeah. And I think this is a key point. This is something I suppose I learned from watching and reading and speaking with Christopher Joy. He came on my podcast during my housing bubble series back in May. And what I learned from him was that it's not a closed system. There are many inputs, and you have to think about the motivations of the actors and the regulators around the housing market and what they're going to do. And this is why, you know, Steve Keen is a mutual friend. I say this to his face, but I call Steve a debt hedgehog. and what I mean by that is Isaiah Berlin famously had this distinction between hedgehogs and foxes. The hedgehog knows one big thing, and foxes know many little things. And Philip Tetlock, who studies forecasting, picked up on this distinction and spoke about two different types of forecasters, hedgehogs and foxes. Steve, I call it a debt hedgehog because he has this one big idea, but it's not adequate to produce accurate forecasts. And famously, you know, in 2008, he said house prices would fall by 40% over the next 10 to 15 years. In other words, over in 15 years. And he was proved wrong because he had this very myopic view of what he thought was the important variable, but these things can go on for so long, especially when there's an ironclad consensus that it should.
And it almost becomes a force of will, doesn't it? Right? If enough people in political circles and economic circles and everything else all say, no, we're not going to allow this to go off the rails, and, you know, ScoMo did that, right?
Yeah.
If you think of his speech just before the election. So you can know that there is a very strong consensus among many different institutions in Australia, all supporting this thing. Right?
Yeah.
The question is, will gravity ultimately win or not? And at what point might it win? And that is an impossible question to answer.
Yeah. And so I think the Reserve Bank, I mean, no other central bank, I think the Reserve Bank has a deep, dark attraction towards our housing market, although they might not let it on publicly. No other central bank in the world has its scorecard, you know, checked so heavily against the house prices of the day. And I think they'll be secretly hoping that we can kind of grow into this bubble. Whether we do is an open question.
And to me, the question ultimately becomes incomes, right?
Yeah.
If the rate of change of income continues as anemic as it is in real terms, to my mind, that's going to put a limit on just how far this thing can stretch.
Yeah.
Right? Because we know that more and more households are actually more and more leveraged.
Yeah.
And the banks, by the way, are also tighter than they were on their lending standards now. So I do think it comes back to an income growth question.
Yeah. Let me pick up on that.
Yeah.
So I attend a lot of property investor seminars as an anthropologist. And
people watching is always fun.
Yeah, I'm surprised I haven't been blacklisted yet. But now, unfortunately, I missed my favorite one a few months ago, which is Dimfner Beholt's I Love Real Estate. She had like a two-day super summit in Sydney. I couldn't go. Probably had things to do with my friends or something. I can't quite remember. But fortunately, she published her keynote speech as a podcast, so I listened to the podcast, and there was a really interesting moment where she asks the crowd, you know, if we experience the same house prices growth over the next 25 years as we experienced in the previous 25 years, what do you think the median value in Sydney will be? And she leaves it hanging, and people start shouting out numbers like 2 million, 3 million. And she waits, and then she says, no, try $6.349 million. And I just thought, wow, this is extrapolation at its finest. Now, Subsequently, I went to a seminar in Western Sydney about 2 weeks later, and they had the same figure, $6.349 million is the median extrapolated house price for Sydney. Mm. And I thought, where are they getting this from? And eventually I tracked it down. I was talking to a friend who actually pointed me in the direction of a report done by Aussie Home Loans in 2017, which was the extrapolated median values for Australia and the capital cities by 2043. Mm. So this is where all of the seminar gurus got it from. Now, if you assume 3% annual wages growth to 2043, a median Sydney property price of $6.349 million would imply a price-to-income ratio of 26x.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So you'd have to be looking at a mortgage of 50 to 80 years.
Yeah.
Right? And maybe intergenerational mortgages are the way to solve the problem.
Yeah.
But you know...
Well, again, so that comes back to the political economy
question.
Absolutely, this is why it's very hard to predict these
things. Absolutely, yeah.
But I still think it's maybe in some sense we could say it's poor process. It's an example of what the psychologist Amos Tversky would call non-consequential reasoning.
Oh, yeah.
Or what maybe Andre Schleifer would call believing that trees can grow to the sky. Hmm. So I find it hard to reconcile beliefs like that Sydney house prices could grow to come in line with a 26x price to income ratio with rational agent models. And it suggests to me that the narratives are very exuberant and therefore fragile.
Yep. So here's my observation. If you look at what happened with income growth in the early 2000s and the freedom of lending growth, so both of those were very strong.
Yeah.
That correlated to very significant property price growth.
Yeah.
Right? Neither of those are now true.
Yeah.
So that's why I believe there is going to be a point at which the bubble cannot get any bigger.
Mm-hmm.
Then the question is, well, does it go sideways or then does it begin to deflate? And that's an unknown. But that's from my modelling, and that's basically looking at the rational data-driven views. But then you've got this other view that you touched on earlier on, which is the psychology over the top, the herd instinct, and that clearly can still support the bubble longer.
Yeah. The reason I think a flatlining might be unlikely is you have so many negatively geared investors in the market. So on the last ATO tax data, we have about 1.3 million Australians with at least one negatively geared investment property, a little over 300,000 with two or more negatively geared investment properties.
And quite a few with 15 and 20, by the way.
Yeah, that's right. My friends who I regularly meet at my seminars. And if you are negatively geared, I mean, generally you have negative cash flow, not always, generally. And that to me is evidence of speculation because you therefore must only be invested for the capital appreciation.
Yep.
If you suddenly tell all these people that prices are just going to flatline, that in and of itself is a reason to sell, which turns the stagnation into a crash.
Yep.
There's other data points around speculation as well, which we can talk about. One is flipping. So on the CoreLogic flipping report in the 2000s, 20.4% of property sales were for flipped properties. In other words, properties bought and then resold within 24 months of the original purchase. By 2017, that had come back down to 7%. Which is why I say there's a different flavor to the two phases of the bubble thus far. The Howard phase was like short-term speculation and the Stevens phase was long-term speculation. It was as if this idea that property is the best investment and you should just hold through market cycles until you're ready to retire had kind of like sunk in at a deep, almost mystical level. And long-term expectations play a definite role in the formation of bubbles. This was, you know, chapter 12 of Keynes's general theory. Mm. So there's the flipping. Then there's also famously, you know, the interest-only loans in Australia, which by 2014, 2015, I think it was like more than 40% of our loan originations, with 70% of those going to investors.
Yep.
Again, if you're getting an interest-only loan and you're not repaying the principal, it's probably because you are holding the property for the resale value. In other words, speculating on capital gains. So that's an inherently unstable market when you have so many. So what is it, like 600,000 properties transacted in Australia per year, roughly?
Yeah, it varies, of course, because they're lower volumes now, but yeah. It certainly was around that.
During the boom times, around that, yeah. And you have 1.3 million Australians with one or more negatively geared investment property.
Yep. Well, you can certainly point to problems in the structure, absolutely. Yeah. But you've also got to recognise that there's more than 1 million unoccupied households who are struggling with the payments on their mortgages now through mortgage stress, according to our analysis. And those are going up. It's never been higher. That's because of flat incomes, rising costs. Mm-hmm. So we know that those pressures are there. So that's why I come back to income is going to be the real test, right? I agree with you on the investment side. We're already seeing from our survey some investors selling now, because they don't believe that the growth is going to be there over the next couple of years, 5 years, whatever. So they're getting out while they can. We're seeing that now. And we're also seeing very little demand from investors for new investment properties at this stage. Mm. So most of the volume that is being sold, much lower than previously, are unoccupied, first-time buyers, people wanting to trade up or trade down.
Yeah.
So the tenor of the market is different from where it was.
Now, a lot of people actually interpret this as a positive thing for Australian house prices.
Right.
So this is one of the other big narratives in the Australian housing market.
Yep.
We have recourse lending.
Yep.
The United States was non-recourse. You had jingle mail, people sending the keys back to the bank and walking away from the properties, properties foreclosing, and that was a big negative externality on house prices.
Yep.
I can't even count the number of times I've had this narrative told to me by very smart people, people who work in finance. I caught up with Peter Switzer earlier in the year at his office on Spring Street in Sydney, and this was one of the first things he said to me in defense of the Australian housing bubble was, we have recourse lending, so people are going to hold on. So let me just put this to rest.
Please do, yes.
So firstly, Ireland in the
2000s. Yeah.
Moreover, Ireland didn't even have proper bankruptcy laws until 2013.
Yep.
Spain in the
2000s. Yep.
Going back further, Japan UK. In the 80s and 90s.
UK, of course, as well.
Yep.
Yep.
Finland
yep.
in the 80s and 90s. Mm. Norway in the 80s and 90s. Sweden in the 80s and 90s.
Mm.
Not only that, recourse versus recourse laws are actually state-based in America. About 39 states, I think, were recourse states.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Including Florida and Nevada, which had among the highest foreclosure rates.
Yep.
So the question is, why doesn't recourse lending prevent a bust or prevent foreclosures? And the answer is, the Richmond Fed did a study on this, and they found recourse lending actually has a small effect for strategic defaults.
Mm.
But otherwise, if you can't afford to repay your mortgage, you can't afford to repay your mortgage.
Exactly. Yep.
And on top of that, in the toxic political environment that surrounds a major housing bust, like, banks just aren't going to enforce it. Like, can you imagine Commonwealth Bank going after people?
And that's the really interesting point, right?
Yeah.
And it's what I keep saying, right? If you were to have a crash, right, if there were a lot of people in default, people wouldn't be foreclosed.
Yeah.
It just wouldn't happen.
Exactly.
Because, one, what would the bank do with thousands and thousands and thousands of properties all in default?
Yeah.
Right? And two, what would it mean in terms of their overall book?
Yeah.
Now, every way you look at it, it doesn't make any sense.
Yeah. And so to bring this point to a close, if anything, the presence of recourse lending should make you more concerned.
Absolutely.
Because it creates a false sense of security for the lenders.
Yep.
They think there's collateral.
Yep.
They think it's safe.
Yep.
And they're more lax in their lending standards, and there's more toxic loans.
Absolutely. And the thing that people haven't realized is that when the banks are doing their mark-to-market, as they quite often do now, they're doing it at an SA3 level.
Yeah.
Which is a very high level, which means that they're not actually looking at the individual movements of individual values of individual properties.
Mm.
What they're looking at is average movements, which masks all of the bad stuff.
Yeah.
Conveniently.
Yeah.
Right. So I have a feeling that whilst the banks recently said, well, we've got 2 or 3% of people in negative equity, right? In some areas, I know that that's actually understating the true state of play. Mm. But nobody wants to talk about that.
Wow.
So there's very much, I think, going back to narrative, right? There is a narrative coming from the banks, everything's fine. There's a narrative saying, see, we've done our mortgage stress testing and everything else, and that's all fine. But if you look carefully at the way it's done, it is actually skewed to be able to actually build a positive story rather than perhaps reality.
Yeah.
So we won't know until the tide goes right out what the true state of those mortgage books are. But my own view is that many lenders have bigger holes in those in their books than they think they have.
Right. Yeah. I wouldn't be surprised.
Okay, so as we come to the end then, we can't predict when the bubble is going to end.
No.
We know that there are multiple factors that are actually influencing it.
Yeah.
But of those multiple factors, which do you think is the most significant?
I mean, my first response would be to say mortgage credit. You know, in the up and the down, it's usually always about the availability of credit.
Right.
Like if people can get their hands on credit, they'll get their hands on credit.
Yep.
So I think that that is pretty key. And the reason I think it's still the most important of the factors is the narratives around the Australian housing market were kept fairly intact during the downturn of 2 years. We had the regulators and the authorities were very good at managing the narrative. This is a healthy mid-correction slowdown, which in hindsight, it probably was. So my answer would be credit availability.
Okay, interesting, because that's, as you know, my major thesis as well.
Yeah.
Of all of the factors in the mix, that's a pretty critical one. So we'll be watching those numbers very closely ahead.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I've really appreciated your time today. It's been a really fascinating conversation. Where can people find about your podcast?
So you can find my podcast wherever you listen to your podcasts. It's called The Jolly Swagman Podcast. I put out episodes roughly every week or two. You can find me on Twitter. My handle is at Joseph N. Walker. You can also find the podcast on my website, which is www.josephnellwalker.com.
Terrific. Thank you very much for your time today. It's been really interesting. And we'll have to tic-tac again as this bubble blows, inflates, explodes. Who knows? Interesting times.
It's been a pleasure, Martin.
Thank you very much. Martin North, Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching. We'll see you again next time.